Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not war yet. The inspectors are still in Iraq. The UN debate goes on. Misgivings, doubt, and wholesale rejection of the military option swirl around the world. But across the Persian Gulf region, the heavy gears of war are turning faster now, by the day, the hour, the minute, inching a 250,000 American and British troops closer to the brink. For soldiers, far from the diplomatic fireworks, it is war that is transfixing, and the full knowledge that they may be, within days, in the midst of war. Over the last 2 days, we've spoken with correspondents now with the troops, or embedded journalists, as the Pentagon calls them, about the furious preparations underway in the Kuwaiti desert and on the waters of the Persian Gulf. What's on the soldiers' minds as they await orders from Washington? How's morale? And what is the troops' understanding of the why of this war? Tonight, On Point, first-hand reports from the front in waiting. Tonight, we're going to hear from war correspondents stationed with troops in the Persian Gulf and from one of the country's leading defense reporters in Washington. Joining us for the hour in Washington as we hear voices in the Gulf is the Washington Post Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent Thomas E. Ricks. He won the Pulitzer for his deep reporting on U.S. military reform. His books include Making the Corps and his latest book, A Soldier's Duty. Good evening and welcome, Tom Ricks.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us, Tom. We're going to hear voices from the field tonight. I know you've spent a lot of time there, and this time you're restricted by the post to Washington, where they want you to keep track of everything Pentagon-wise. But you know the field very well. You're watching all the reports come in right now, Tom Ricks. What is your sense of the U.S. military's readiness and how the diplomatic debate that continues to go on globally affects or does not affect that?
Well, I was out in the Persian Gulf region in January before the post restricted me to base here. Mm-hmm. My sense then was that they were ramping up, as they call it, very quickly, and that really around the middle of next week, they are going to reach what they would consider their maximum point of readiness. They don't have everything in place right now, but they're close to it. They'll have it soon. And key also is that a lot of key assets, especially helicopters, have been now in Kuwait out in the desert for a few days. And it's really essential to give pilots some orientation when they come in. It's very different flying out in the desert. It's easy to confuse a dirty, sort of cloudy, dusty sky with sand dunes. Mm-hmm. They've had pilots flying to sand dunes in the past. Also, dust when you're landing is very important to get accustomed to. There's a problem known as a brownout, where they really lose orientation as they're coming for landing and they get a cloud of dust up. There was a Black Hawk crash not long ago in the Kuwaiti desert that seemed to involve some of those factors.
Tom, one thing we're not going to be hearing tonight is correspondents in Turkey waiting for the U.S. military to jump off from the north. Of course, Turkey has refused to give U.S. permission to do that and now is even talking about further restrictions on use of Turkish airspace. How significant is that?
I think it is more significant than we've recognized. I think the Pentagon has downplayed it successfully, but I'm hearing a lot of rumblings that actually this is a real crimp in the war plan and an unexpected crimp, and that while, yes, they can come up with a plan B of some sort, it is really not something they like doing.
And the consequences, will it take longer? Does it mean more casualties? How does it play out?
Probably for the U.S., the consequences, there will be some. There will be some casualties. It'll take a bit longer. But the real consequences are probably for the region itself. There's a lot of suspicion in Washington that the most difficult part of Iraq will be that northern part where you have the Kurds, the Turks, the Iranians.
And the oil fields.
And the oil fields all banging into each other, all with interest and overlapping claims. And that could be a very difficult, confusing area. And the lack of a U.S. presence early on increases the risk that the oil fields will be torched by Saddam Hussein on his way out the door, increases the risk of a Turkish-Kurdish clash in the north between two ostensible allies of the U.S., increases the likelihood, perhaps, of the Iranians saying, well, everybody else is staking a claim, we will too.
And what about the diplomatic debate that continues, Tom? President Bush continues to say, we want peace until we have to pull the trigger on war. Is that really the case from a military perspective? I suppose until the commander-in-chief says go, they don't go. But is it beyond some point of no return, or is there such a thing?
Clearly, in mechanical terms, anything that can be turned on can be turned off, and the U.S. military is a giant machine in that sense. But in political strategic terms, I think you're putting your finger on something. I think there is a tipping point, and I think it has been passed in the sense that strategically, the United States cannot gin up for war like that and then say to the Middle East, like Emily Latilla, oh, never mind. So I think, yeah, I think war is inevitable in the sense that either Saddam Hussein goes or the U.S. military will push him out. But U.S. credibility in the region would be utterly shot. The Arabs would say, go home and don't bother us again if somehow the United States left Saddam Hussein in place after this point.
Tom Ricks, we are going to hear a lot from the region tonight. We have a rich handful of correspondents that we've spoken to over the last day and a half. Let's turn to them and begin to get that feeling right from the front. The first correspondent we're going to hear from is Scott Calvert. He's embedded with the 101st Airborne Division. He's with the Baltimore Sun. Scott traveled with those troops, from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to Kuwait last week. He joined us from what's called Camp Pennsylvania in the Kuwaiti desert. When I spoke with him, he was in the midst of one of the many sandstorms that the troops have been dealing with on a daily basis. I asked him to tell me where he was and why.
I'm actually sitting inside a scud bunker here at Camp Pennsylvania because a sandstorm suddenly came out of nowhere, and this is the only place I could get to get out of this awful driving sand.
Scott, what is a scud bunker?
It's a concrete structure that can hold, I don't know, maybe 40 guys if they're packing them in here pretty tightly. There are sandbags on the top and the side. And basically, if they got an alert that a scud had been launched, everybody would come out here and kind of cram inside and see where the thing landed.
Scott Calvert, you're with the 101st. Can you tell us where you are, how long you've been with the troops there?
I'm about 30 miles from the Iraqi border. This is a one-mile square camp. There's several of these camps in northern Kuwait. We're right out in the Kuwaiti desert. As far as the eye can see, there's nothing but sand, sand, and more sand. The 3rd Infantry Division of the Army had been here prior to our arrival, so it was a fairly well-established camp. I mean, it's not exactly luxury living, but we've got showers, and there is hot food for breakfast and hot food at dinner, and we sleep in tents. I'm actually pretty lucky. I have a cot to sleep on.
Scott, what is the level to your eye of war readiness in the camp that you're sitting in at this moment?
Well, I think they're getting pretty ready. During the day, the guys are out training. They're working on urban warfare drills. They're doing night vision goggle sorts of things in the evening. They're doing lots of physical training. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of lying around. There's a lot of just sort of kicking back and letting the soldiers kind of chill out a bit. They don't want to work them so hard that by the time a war might start, they're just too tuckered out.
You mentioned a sandstorm there right now. You've written about sand being an ever-present element in the soldier's life. How bothersome is it now, and how bothersome might it be in battle?
You know, it's funny. We had a really bad sandstorm Thursday night and for most of Friday that made it really unpleasant to be outside of your tent for any length of time. You know, at its worst, you can't see more than 50 feet, and it's like a blizzard, only you're being pelted with sand. It gets into everything. It gets into the tents. It gets into your mouth. It gets into food you're trying to eat. It's really a menace. The one upside for the Army here that they say is that this would affect the Iraqis just the same. And, in fact, it makes it much more difficult to launch any kind of chemical attack because when the winds are whipping up like this, it just disperses it and makes it hard to control. So that's sort of the silver lining.
Do the soldiers see that silver lining? How much on their minds is the possibility of chemical and biological attack?
Not a whole lot. I mean, they'll talk about it, but, you know, you don't hear a whole lot of war talk. It's hard to know whether they are trying to sort of keep themselves distracted and not dwell on the possibility or just what. But there's no question that this is a very stressful environment, and people's nerves are getting frayed. They're living on top of each other 24/7. They're away from their family and their friends, and they're in this unforgiving climate. And add to that, they might be going to war soon.
You describe a scene where a young private inadvertently took someone else's anthrax pills, and it just about turned into a melee.
Yeah, it was the kind of thing. It was a simple mistake, more or less. This private saw some anthrax pills on the floor and put them into his gas mask case. Then when they do what they call a sensitive items check, another private couldn't find his anthrax pills, and that's when it was discovered that this other fellow had taken the pills that weren't his. And he and his sergeant really got into it, and it actually turned into a fight. The second sergeant, who saw this, just came sprinting down the tent and tackled the guys to get them apart.
Scott, do you have a chance to talk with U.S. troops there about, or do they talk about, the why of the war? Do they believe they'll soon be at war or that it might still be averted?
No, I think they think that they will, in fact, be at war pretty soon. If they are having doubts about the why, the reason for doing this, they're not talking about that too openly. That's a pretty heavy thing to essentially contradict their commander-in-chief. It's pretty taboo. I mean, it's even more taboo, I think, than having the illicit porn that they're not supposed to have and maybe trying to brew up some homebrew in their tents. You know, for most of these guys, this is the first time around. There are some folks who were here in the Gulf War back in 1991, but 12 years is a long time in the military, and there are a lot of guys who are just out of basic training who are here. They look like young kids. They are 18 or they're 19. They just don't know what quite to expect. But even the veterans will admit to feeling a little bit queasy because, after all, if there's a war, then who knows what's going to happen. But, you know, there is one thing that I did want to add that's kind of interesting. If you do talk to soldiers, one of the things that you hear a lot is they say, well, you know, Saddam Hussein, you know, he was involved in bringing down the Twin Towers, and so therefore this is payback. And I thought it was interesting that to hear so many of these guys state as fact that Saddam Hussein was behind September 11th when nobody's really documented that link does in fact exist. But the bottom line, though, is that these guys, you know, they're ready to go. There's some trepidation, there's some nervousness, but you know what? After living here for a couple weeks and dealing with a sandstorm such as the one that is blowing all around my head right now, any place is better than this almost.
Scott Calvert, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Keep your head down.
I will, thanks.
Scott Calvert is a correspondent embedded with the 101st Airborne Division for the Baltimore Sun. He spoke with me from a Scud bunker at Camp Pennsylvania in Kuwait. We are talking tonight with war correspondents on what is likely to very soon be the front in war with Iraq. We're joined from Washington by Thomas E. Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent for The Washington Post. And, Tom, you know the sound of noise in a sat phone line, but you could also, like me, hear the sound very clearly there of wind and sand.
And the vibes came through as I was listening to Scott talk. I thought to myself, you know, been there, done that. This sounds like a very typical, normal deployment, especially his last line. You know, let's get on with the attack, sort of the feeling anything would be better than this. There's always a suspicion among soldiers that they're trying to bore you to death so that you'll prefer combat to just sitting around. Anything. Let's just get going.
Tom, give us in broad strokes, if and when this comes, what this campaign is going to look like. You've written that it will be remarkably different from anything the U.S. military has ever done.
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans who are watching this casually kind of expect this to be Gulf War, the sequel. And the word from people involved in it, both over in the Persian Gulf and at the Pentagon, is no, this is going to be very different from the Gulf War. You're not going to have 5 weeks of bombing followed by a ground campaign. You're going to see, almost from the get-go, ground operations and air operations really simultaneous or overlapping. In fact, there's a school of thought that I think has a lot of credibility that the war has effectively begun already. In marketing terms, it's been a soft launch. You've got special operators on the ground inside Iraq. They've really drastically increased the number of sorties in the no-fly zones from just like 100 a day air flights to 400, 500, even 1,000 one day.
And Tom, paint a mental picture for us, a mental map of what the formal onset would look like then. What will the arrows look like on the maps that we inevitably see when and if that comes?
Well, the traditional American way of beginning a war that people reach back to is cruise missiles flying down streets in downtown Baghdad and taking a right turn at the intersection. I think this might be somewhat different. You will probably see the launch of ground operations and the air campaign on about the same time. I think they're still debating quite exactly how they're going to do that. The arrows will start flying pretty quickly. You'll have ground forces heading out of Kuwait up across Baghdad, U.S. forces, probably with British forces also, dashing very quickly across the desert, bypassing possible Iraqi resistance, and really not expecting that much of a fight from Iraqi forces. Their big worry is the handful of Republican Guard divisions, the more elite forces.
How many days or hours to the gates of Baghdad?
it's anybody's guess, but the smart money says 4 to 7 days, which is very high speed. That's about 350 miles. And ground forces typically, I think they're moving very fast if they move 20 miles a day.
Tom Rick, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're going to be right back. We're talking tonight with war correspondents on the front and with Thomas E. Rick's Washington Post Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent in Washington about what may soon be war with Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight with war correspondents, soon to be, perhaps, if, when, you know all the conditional words, but very likely to soon be at the war front in and around Iraq. We just heard before the break from Scott Calvert with the Baltimore Sun. We'll hear in just a moment from Rick Atkinson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent with the Washington Post. But before we go to Rick, Thomas E. Ricks, a Washington Post military correspondent, is with us tonight. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner himself for his deep reporting on military reform. And Tom, I know you've kind of written the Bible, at least for Post reporters, or helped write it, on preparation for this embedding, where soldiers are actually assigned or sign up to be with U.S. troops. They do not carry firearms, but they're responsible for their own gear, their safety equipment, flak jackets, helmets and suits, their own chemical and biological gear. As we understand it, these reporters can be with units, they're told, in advance for weeks or months. They take the same risks of, quote, extreme and unpredictable hazards of war that the military do. This is going to be tough on correspondents, too.
It's very tough. I think surprisingly tough for two reasons. First, a lot of reporters are not in as good shape as young 19-year-old troops. Mm-hmm. They're older. They're not as physically resilient. Infantry work is very tough work. It breaks bodies. I've always been sympathetic to military retirement at 20 years for infantry people. Mm-hmm. When you're 38, you're 40, your body can't take a whole lot more of jumping off of trucks, wearing 100-pound packs, or flinging yourself on the ground. The extreme abuse a body takes of only having 2 hours of sleep, you know, at a time.
And for a while, these correspondents will share in that.
They share in that, and also, you're alone. You are not part of the unit. After a while, you might become friendly or feel comfortable, but fundamentally, you are not a comrade. You are there to report about them. You are the other. And so there is a real psychological loneliness, I think, for a lot of these embedded reporters.
And in a situation this time where there are new threats, or perhaps more pressing threats, at least in people's mind and perhaps more than before, especially on the chem bio front, reporters are told to be sure to shave closely so that the gas masks can fit tightly over their face, to have that they'll be wearing just underwear and T-shirt under the full chem bio suit if and when that's necessary. Yesterday, I spoke with Rick Atkinson, a Pulitzer Prize winner, also embedded with the 101st Airborne, again for the Washington Post. He's the author of Crusade, The Untold Story of the Persian Gulf War, and of An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942 to 1943. Rick spoke with me from Camp Doha, the main U.S. military base in Kuwait. I asked him to describe the 101st Airborne and how it fits into the overall attack plan.
Well, the 101st Airborne Division is unique, not only in the American Army, but really in the world. There are about 17,000 soldiers, and for this operation, they've been supplemented by about 3,000 others. They travel into battle by helicopter. They have 90 Black Hawk helicopters, which transport troops and cargo. They have several dozen Chinook helicopters, the big twin-rotored helicopters that can carry troops and cargo. And then they have about 74 Apache attack helicopters. And the division has the capacity to move an entire brigade of about 3,000 to 4,000 soldiers 100 miles or so in 6 hours. So you can move essentially the whole division in 3 nights.
Can you describe the fire control radar system or the technology of the new Longbow model of the Apache and how that works?
Well, the Longbow is the newest version of the Apache, and it has pretty amazing capability to unmask, as they call it, which is to pop from behind a hill. And in a fraction of a second, the radar systems on the Longbow can take a kind of snapshot of the terrain around the Longbow, and it can acquire 1,000 or more potential targets, and it sorts them by the type of targets, whether it's a wheeled vehicle, a track vehicle like a tank. And can sort through almost instantly through these various targets and determine which ones should be attacked first. And it sorts through them, and it can program the Hellfire missiles, which the Apache carries, up to 16 Hellfires. And Hellfires will go kill those respective targets.
where's the center of gravity feel now? Is this force leaning toward Iraq, or is it still hunkered down very much in Kuwait? How does that feel?
There is a sense of anticipation, a sense that, something is going to happen in a matter of a few weeks at most, and probably just a couple weeks.
You describe subtle psychological changes in the troops as that time or anticipated time grows closer. Can you describe some of that for us?
Well, among other things, when people are passing here through Doha, you see them beginning to scrounge in the greatest military tradition. People are stockpiling toilet paper, for example, because there are shortages sometimes in the camps. People look around for things that might be useful in the field craft of a rustic environment like these camps, a piece of string lying on the street. You know, can I use that? Will it fit into my pack? There's a run on the PX supplies here. Baby wipes are a huge commodity. I'm holding one in my hand right now because the dust is so thick, it just coats everything almost instantly. So there is a transition period, I think, both collectively for the military and individually for these soldiers as they move from the habits of peace, the mentality of peace, into something that's much closer to war.
Does the furious debate over this war in the UN and elsewhere translate into these forward positions?
It's pretty distant, to be honest with you. Here at Camp Doha, they do have televisions in the mess hall. You see CNN, Fox News. It's more background noise, and certainly when you're out in the camps, it's clutter in the distance at most. The soldiers are pretty focused on what they're doing. They're aware that there's a real division of opinion both in the United States and not a lot of support internationally for this. They talk about it some. They don't talk about it a lot. You don't hear a lot of deep political debate here.
And what is your sense, Rick, of the why of war that soldiers there carry in the back of their mind? Is there a justification that's on the lips of people when and if they talk about it?
Well, it's frequently discussed by the soldiers in terms of September 11th. They link it, whether rightly or wrongly, to the attack on the United States. And I think they generally buy into President Bush's rationale and his efforts to link this into a large proactive attempt to make the country safer somehow. Always when soldiers are going into battle, the most important motivation is the soldier next to them on the left and on the right. That's why men and in these days women will die for one another in combat. They die for one another. They don't die for a cause. They're not really dying for the country.
And if the diplomatic debate means a prolonged wait for this invasion, what's your sense, Rick Atkinson, of how that may impact morale, may impact physical readiness?
Well, it gets hot here very quickly. Today was quite lovely. You could have been in Southern California until this shamal, the windstorm with a tremendous dust blew through. But within the next few weeks, temperatures are going to routinely be up around 100. And as you get closer to the summer, they get pretty substantially into the hundreds. It's hard to stay poised and cocked, ready to go for extended periods of time. Now, there are soldiers here, including those with 101st and commanders with 101st, who are perfectly happy to have a little more time. They are the last ones to arrive. Their ships are still coming in. Their equipment is still coming in. They've not had a whole lot of time to train. In some cases, they've had no time to train. For pilots, in particular, flying in these conditions is very tricky, and it requires an opportunity to get used to it. To make a night landing in a dust storm is very hard, and particularly if you're used to flying in Kentucky, where the division's from. So it cuts both ways. I think a short respite would be generally welcomed by a lot of the folks here. If it drags out, then that becomes more problematic.
You describe, Rick, combat soldiers carrying the obligatory big knife on their belts, but also the gas masks. How much on people's minds is that risk, that threat of a chemical or biological attack by Iraq?
It's omnipresent because soldiers are required to think of it all the time. Yesterday, for example, here at Camp Doha, the soldiers who are based here, not the 101st, because they're just passing through, but the soldiers who are actually based here, and there are thousands of them, were required to wear what's called their J-lets, their protective suits. And they wore them around all day to get used to them, to make sure that they had their stuff, everybody is required to carry their gas mask at all times. Whenever you go anywhere, you're supposed to have your gas mask with you. So it's a prudent precaution, I think, by the leadership of the military here to have them cognizant of the threat, have them preparing for the threat, whether they're likely to get hit with anything. Who knows? That's one of the several $64,000 questions.
And Rick, finally, you know, President Bush and others in his administration continue to say that their preferred path would be peace. Can these soldiers, can you imagine at this point this force being stood down, being turned around?
It's a little hard to imagine because there does seem to be a momentum to the whole thing. You certainly feel it here in Kuwait, where the great flood tide of equipment and soldiers pouring into the country is really ceaseless. There's an ambivalence that many feel. You know, having come this far, trained this hard, been forced to think about combat, been forced to prepare for combat, I think, you know, many are ready to do it. On the other hand, I don't think there's a soldier here who wouldn't at heart feel a sense of relief and a sense of glad tidings if, in fact, simply the threat that they pose caused the Iraqis to come around to whatever state of mind it is that President Bush requires in order to call this off. Anything that can prevent the shedding of blood, I think, is welcomed more by soldiers than by anybody else.
Rick Atkinson, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you there.
Thanks very much. It was my pleasure.
Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson is embedded with the 101st Airborne for the Washington Post. He's the author of Crusade, The Untold Story of the Persian Gulf War. His most recent book is An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942 to 1943. He spoke with us from Camp Doha in Kuwait. I'm joined by Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize winner with the Washington Post and an old friend. Tom, you can hear in Rick's voice there the voice of someone who knows what's coming, if indeed it comes.
You really can. I have enormous admiration for Rick Atkinson. When he came out of his new life as a historian to come back to the paper, it was like having Mickey Mantle ask if he could play on your ball team. Here's a guy who knows his history, has written two or three of the best books on the modern U.S. military, as well as a good World War II history.
And right now he's sucking sand with the rest of them. This issue of chemical biological attack comes up again. It always seems to hang in the air around this possible war. You talked about 4 to 7 days to Baghdad, Tom. Does that change if Saddam unleashes chemical, biological weapons?
Chemical or biological could slow you down, especially if it were at a key choke point on your route, like at a bridge or something. But it really is not that much of a military problem. The military answer to a chemical attack is a step on the gas pedal.
To blow by it, that is.
Yeah. It's more what they consider an area denial weapon. If something gets smeared with persistent chemicals like VX, it makes it more difficult to go into that area. You can go into it properly equipped. It's much more of a problem for civilians. But really, the emphasis you see right now on chemical preparation at these bases in Kuwait is entirely appropriate because the military considers this moment, right now, for the next week, the maximum point of danger.
When all the troops are concentrated as an easy target.
That's right. It's not when they're driving in their M1A2 tanks at you at 40 miles an hour, and they're all buttoned up and you can't touch them because inside a tank you're protected from chemicals. It's when the troops are assembled. That really is the maximum point of vulnerability. That's why you're seeing these drills and everybody having to wear their chem suits around.
Tom, stand by. I want to swing out to sea now, where, of course, many U.S. forces are also based. Carol Williams is a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. She's embedded with the crew of the U.S. aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, now in the Persian Gulf. Before that, she was on the USS Constellation. I asked Carol Williams how U.S. sailors have been coping with the waiting game.
Well, I think some of the journalists who have been around here for a while are very much in tune with the emotions of the crews on board the U.S. ships here. You know, we've been turning circles in the Gulf and waiting for what seems like the inevitable to begin. But, you know, there's a lot of receding and advancing of the threat of war. And that leads to a lot of frustration and impatience and uncertainty and discomfort. Today, the crew of the USS Lincoln had a day off at sea. They have what they call a steel beach picnic where they cleared the flight deck as much as they could. They had a barbecue and were, you know, grilling hamburgers and hot dogs and, you know, different kind of foods than they've been having for the past 8 months. This ship has been at sea longer than any of the others in the region, and there's very strong and palpable impatience, and I think these guys really want to happen whatever's going to happen so they can get their jobs done and get home.
Carol, you've written about this emotional cocktail affecting crew members in the different venues, ships and elsewhere that you've been. Is there a varying terrain of morale? Do you see ups and downs, or is everybody straining at the bit or against loneliness now?
I think everybody feels like they've been out here poised to deal with the mission when it is handed to them. The Lincoln more so than the other ships because it has been out here for so long and they have the added disappointment and morale hit of having been turned around when they were almost home and kind of mentally psyched for seeing their families again and getting back on shore into civilian life for a while. That said, most of the sailors and aviators feel that, you know, they've been out here, they've been extended, they've made sacrifices, but it would be for naught if they got turned around and sent home at this point. So they're kind of willing to go that extra 9 yards to get the job done and to feel like they've taken part in a historical mission that they are uniquely prepared for and that this is what they trained throughout their military careers to deal with.
Carol, you know that there's a great debate going on globally and in the United States about the war. How much attention do you see military personnel paying to that? Do they feel that they're at the center of a controversy? Do they feel supported by their own country?
Some of them do. I had a conversation about this with some guys today. Some of them are offended or upset by the protests and the opposition to the war. But others have said, and down to the very lowest ranks, that part of what they're supposed to be fighting for is the right to free speech and the other guarantees of the U.S. Constitution and of any democracy. And they recognize that people have the right to disagree with the opinion of the leadership or with the activities that they'll be involved in.
And, Carol Williams, is there the sense among the sailors that you're with that war is now just days away? Is there a sense of countdown at this point?
No, and I think this is a unique situation on the Lincoln because this crew has been, yanked back and forth and, made to expect something imminently only to see it recede on the horizon. These guys, they don't know what's coming. They don't know when it's coming. They don't believe or hope for anything anymore. They're just standing and waiting to be told, when the balloon's going to go up. Those of us who have boarded the ship more recently have a sense that, we're down to the 11th hour, but the Lincoln crewmen are very wary of predictions about, when this is going to happen, when they'll get their mission completed, and when they can go home.
And what are your plans, Carol Williams, when and if war comes, where will you be?
I'll be here on the ship, writing about it.
On the Lincoln. Good luck to you, and thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Nice to talk with you.
Carol Williams, correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. She's embedded on board the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, now in the Persian Gulf. Tom Rex, we've just got 20 seconds before the break, but how important the shipboard element when and if this comes?
Well, there are five ships, five carriers, and that's an awful lot of air power, especially when they're dropping precision-guided munitions, which they didn't do from the Navy in the Gulf War.
We are talking tonight with war correspondents in the field as the U.S. military prepares for what could now be an imminent invasion of Iraq. The soldiers, it sounds like, are getting ready to go. Tom Ricks is joining us from Washington. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are spending the hour tonight speaking with American correspondents, war correspondents now, at the periphery of Iraq. They are, all of them, embedded with troops there who are now waiting for the order to proceed with war. We're joined from Washington tonight by Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent Thomas E. Ricks, who's been listening along with us and sharing with us his experience, both from the former Gulf War and of many long days and months himself with U.S. troops. Tom, just before the break, we heard from Carol Williams on the aircraft carrier Lincoln, and you were noting that the Navy will, for this time, what's the distinction you were making there?
Well, during the Gulf War, the Navy did not have a lot of precision-guided munitions, that is, smart bombs.
Mm-hmm.
They really hadn't gotten with that, and they realized during the Gulf War that it really inhibited their ability to contribute to the air campaign. The Navy has really focused on that over the last 10 years. It's one reason that the amount of firepower that's going to be brought to bear is going to be so extraordinary, I think, in the opening volley of this coming war. Is the naval aviation component is going to be a lot more effective. They're going to be able to put one bomb on one target and take care of it and not have to go back three or four or have 15 planes all try to take their shot and miss it.
Tom, for those of us who don't follow it as closely, what's the division of labor then between Air Force and Navy going to be if and when this campaign comes?
You're going to have several hundred aircraft out of each component, the Air Force and the Navy, as well as cruise missiles being fired. So you're going to have long-range bombers and shorter-range fighter-bomber aircraft from the Air Force. You'll have fighter-bombers off of the five carriers. I think you probably see round-the-clock air operations, which you did not see in the Gulf War. During the Gulf War, they mainly flew only at night.
And what will the Air Force bases be?
The Air Force has a lot of fighter-bombers in Kuwait and down in the smaller states along the Persian Gulf Coast. They also are moving B-2 bombers today to, it looks like to me, like England and the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. They'll also be flying B-1 bombers and B-52s from those bases further away.
And if they don't get flyover rights in Turkey, in addition to the Turkish parliament declining to invite U.S. troops to launch out off their soil, how big a deal is that?
Not so much for the air campaign, though it would be nice. The real war for air campaign is being able to fly aircraft out of the base the U.S. uses in Incirlik, Turkey, in sort of near the northern mm-hmm. part of Iraq.
Tom, in the Gulf War, there was all the debate about what we were actually seeing when we saw bombs kind of going down chimneys with this super tight precision, we were told, and there was some kind of conventional wisdom became after the war that the weapons were not as precise as civilians and the media had been led to believe. Is there a risk of that this time? Will it really be as precise as we're being told?
I think it'll be extremely precise, but that's different from antiseptic. It'll be precise and bloody. It'll be messy. Military actions destroy things. They kill people and destroy things, and that's their nature. It really is, I think, a state of walking psychosis, a state of war. That said, the big difference is in the Gulf War, only about 10% of bombs dropped were precision-guided munitions. This time, I think it'll be 70% overall and 80 or 90% in any sort of built-up areas. And, those bombs are precise. The mistake the Pentagon made back then was they only showed you the good video, the good hits. They didn't show the bombs going awry. And a precision-guided bomb can go wrong if it's aimed with the wrong information, like the Chinese embassy in Belgrade mm-hmm. during the Kosovo campaign. If a fin doesn't work on a bomb, the bomb will be misdirected. And laser-guided bombs, which is one form of precision munitions, have the additional difficulty of occasionally a bomb just won't pick up the laser beam, mm-hmm. or it'll be blinded by the dirt and the dust and the smoke of the battlefield.
But they all destroy when they hit. And another very simple question, but you know the traditional image we have in video, there's the aircraft high above the ground and a long kind of train, like a nest full of eggs of bombs falling out from beneath. Is that what we're going to see, even with precision bombing? Do you see that kind of big trail of bombs just kind of, spreading out across the sky beneath the aircraft, or is it one at a time going to particular targets?
It's both. With smaller aircraft, it's kind of that old sniper mentality, one shot, one kill, where they really do focus on a target. But you can also do things which, really, because of the new technology and navigation, you can have a B-52, the classic big, dumb mm-hmm. bomber, mm-hmm. dropping a string of bombs that they then can either be a smart bomb that picks up a target, or because they're navigating so precisely, they can drop dumb bombs, the old iron bomb, in a very narrowly defined box, maybe 1 kilometer by 2 kilometers, and only drop them in that area with a pretty good certainty. And effectively, you're using the B-52 for close air support, something that nobody ever thought would be possible.
But 1 kilometer by 2 kilometers can still include an awful large variety of human life.
If it's in downtown Baghdad, yes. But what they did in Afghanistan, that's how they hit the Taliban front lines. Mm-hmm. With some precision. I remember a guy saying, we told them to hit the guys who were wearing the red turbans, but not the guys hitting the black turbans.
Well, good if you can do it. Tom, I want to get another report from the Gulf region. Yaroslav Trofimov is Middle East and Mediterranean correspondent with the Wall Street Journal. He spent time in Kuwait with both U.S. and British troops, the U.S. Army 5th Corps, the U.K. 16th Air Assault Brigade, and the U.K. 7th Transport Regiment. He's written about a psychological divide between U.S. and British troops on the ground in Kuwait. I asked him to describe that divide for us.
The Americans know that most people back in the United States do back what the president is planning to do and do back going to war with Iraq. And obviously, at the same time, in Britain, just a few weeks ago, there was the biggest anti-war demonstration in recent memory. So the soldiers have families, they have friends back in their own country, and obviously the British soldiers do feel a little bit uneasy about going to war without their country's backing.
There are about 21,000 British soldiers now in Kuwait. Are they stationed among American troops or in entirely separate areas? And what will their role be if and when war begins?
By now, there are probably about 26,000 British soldiers because they keep coming in. Most of them are going to be cooperating with the U.S. Marines. And actually, there will be some U.S. Marine units under British command and some British units under U.S. command. Pre-integrated with the U.S. operations. However, the Brits do stay in separate camps.
And when you say they're working with U.S. Marines, does that suggest that they'll be going in the first waves of U.S. and British troops?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, the British troops, a large part of them are highly trained professional combat troops. For example, the soldiers of the 16th Air Assault Brigade have served in Afghanistan. They have served in a war situation in Macedonia. So they do go from hotspot to hotspot all the time.
You write that living conditions and equipment for British troops are better this time than in the 1991 Gulf War. How so?
Back then, people were complaining about the lack of essential supplies. And now, the conditions in the British camps are basically the same as in the U.S. camps. They're tough. People live maybe 70 in a tent. There is usually very little water. And they have to eat meals ready to eat for lunch. However, the Brits do complain much more about their living conditions. And in the British press, there were just stories after stories based on letters that soldiers write home about how tough the conditions in the desert are.
But you write that British soldiers are not permitted to call home with the same ease as American soldiers. Is that right?
Well, I don't think the American soldiers are permitted either. The thing is that a normal mobile phone that pretty much everyone in Britain has would also work here, which is not the case for American mobile phones. And so the soldiers would normally carry such phones with them whenever they travel. However, this time around they were told to not to bring them or to give them to the officers because people are afraid of compromising operational security. Remember that mobile phone signals can be picked up with fairly simple equipment and the source of the call can be located.
Yaroslav, what about the threat of chemical or biological attack? Do soldiers talk about it there? Is it particularly on their minds? Are they prepared on a hair trigger to respond if there's evidence of such an attack already underway?
Soldiers train both in the U.S. camps and the British camps pretty much every day now. They train how to put on the gas masks in 9 seconds. They train how to put on their chemical suits. And right now the condition is not on a high level because people don't think there will be an attack imminent. However, wherever they go, they do have to carry with them the gas masks, even when they jog in the mornings. And they have to carry, in British camps, in their backpacks, their chemical suits. They're not actually walking in their chemical suits yet. So presumably, as things would escalate, they would be going from this condition to higher states of alert and actually wear the chemical suits, minus the gas masks, all the time.
Do you have a sense of the timetable that soldiers there, British soldiers there, are anticipating? Do they expect to go to war any day now?
As far as the troop readiness goes, I think this last couple of days, all the last pieces of the puzzle fell in, and they are ready. Both the British and the American troops are ready to go, should there be a political signal to do so. However, obviously, everything depends on the decision of the government, both in Washington and London. But as far as the military is concerned, I think they're ready to go any day now.
And if they do go in, Yaroslav, is it your sense from the British soldiers that they anticipate a quick and successful mission or that they're anticipating the possibility of something more complicated?
Obviously, people who will have to do the fighting are bracing for the worst and hoping for the best. So people do think that it will be harder this time than it was back in 1991, for the simple reason that back then the war was to evict Saddam Hussein's Iraq from a different country, from Kuwait. Right now it would be to evict Saddam Hussein's regime from its own country, which by definition is much harder. So there is this foreboding of possibly more difficult battles ahead. And obviously what especially frightens people is the threat of chemical and biological weapons.
Yaroslav Trofimov, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Yaroslav Trofimov is Middle East and Mediterranean correspondent with The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Fahil, Kuwait. Tom Ricks, military correspondent with The Washington Post, joins us from Washington. Tom, again, in this interview, you hear ready, ready, ready. You must hear and feel that all the time in your capacity there in Washington, and yet you live in the United States as well. You continue to hear all the debate and anguish debate very often about whether or not we should even be having this war. Are you left with a conflicted reality there, Tom, hearing the readiness in the field and the concerns at home?
I am a bit. There's also some worry about this inside the U.S. military, and it relates to that. One is that our military has become so good, so effective, that it's become easy to use. That the hurdle, the bar for the use of force is lowered.
Because leaders feel so confident.
Because they know they're going to win, because they're pretty confident they're going to do it with a relatively small number of casualties, and because you can do it precisely and so also reduce, not eliminate, but reduce civilian casualties. Mm-hmm. What the U.S. did in Kosovo would have been impossible for any military in the world 10 years ago, and really is only possible by the U.S. military now. We bombed Belgrade very precisely, hitting individual buildings and bridges. Mm-hmm. Any other nation would have had to incur thousands of civilian casualties to do that. So it's become easier to use force. They know they can prevail with a relatively small number of casualties all around. If they thought differently, I think the generals would actually be much more vigorous in their opposition. There were a lot of doubts about this war inside the Pentagon. And then after a while, they said, okay, the Bush administration, they run the show. You know, we are subordinates to civilians, and we'll go and do it. And I asked a general the other day who was against it, and he said, I still don't think it's the right thing to do, but, a couple of hundred casualties, we're out of there, and those guys are in charge.
But as you've written, Tom, maybe a couple hundred casualties, but not we're out of there. The military is also aware that there'll be a long tail of occupation post-war, indeed it's successful.
Yes, and here there's a division within the military, which is the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps maybe get to go home, and the Army is stuck holding the bag. And there's a lot of worries in the United States Army about that, about becoming mired in a kind of occupation. We don't have a very big Army by historical standards. We have a 10-division active duty Army. And they think at least two, maybe three divisions will be tied up in Iraq for years to come.
Tom Ricks, we're almost out of time. You watch everything that's going on so closely. You see both the debate at the UN and around the country and preparations. Do you have a sense of if it comes, when it's going to come?
I think sooner rather than later. My gut feeling is probably the end of next week.
And how will we know?
You may not know. It's not going to be, I think, the traditional, hey, war has begun. I think we're doing a lot of stuff right now that really is effectively amounts to war. But I think you may also have an ultimatum issued by the president, 72 hours. I think a major signal also will be UN inspectors leaving Baghdad. That probably means the balloon goes up pretty soon after that.
Tom Ricks, I want to thank you so much for listening along with us this evening to these correspondents in the field. It's been great to have your perspective on everything we've heard. Just terrific.
Thank you.
Tom Ricks is Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent for The Washington Post. His latest book is A Soldier's Duty. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Tamar Morad, James Roth, John Roberts, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoke, with help from Sabi Mir. Special thanks tonight to John Hoder. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR Boston.